The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
Okay, here's a test. Were you paying attention to the Old Testament reading in church this Sunday? Oh, you're excused. You had a different reading. Oh, well, okay. Some folks heard a reading from the Old Testament book of Amos, chapter 8. Now, I've got a question for our Ask the Pastor guest, the Reverend Dr. Martin Nolan, pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Good morning, Pastor.
Morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Great. Thank you. Just waiting for fall to come here any day.
Any day. Let's see. Does fall come on the 21st or the 22nd this year?
I don't know.
I guess I have to look that up.
Daylight savings time starts or ends?
Well, that'll be at the end of, well, it's in the beginning of November, I guess. But you're in Indiana,
oh, okay.
So you Indianans, you go crazy over there.
They never know what they're doing. They've changed the laws so often,
yeah.
And the counties that are in and out of the central time zone keeps changing every couple of years.
So well, that's keep figure. You on your toes. That's a good thing. Did you happen to have Amos chapter 8 in among your church readings over the weekend?
Yeah, that looks familiar. I think we did.
Well, I have a question for you. Let me just read it so folks can hear what we're talking about. This is Amos 8, verses 4 through 7. The reading is, "Hear this, you who trample on the needy and bring the poor to the land, poor of the land to an end, saying, when will the new moon be over, that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath, that we may offer wheat for sale, that we may make the ephah small and the shekel great, and deal deceitfully with false balances, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, and sell the chaff of the wheat. The Lord has sworn by the pride of Jacob, surely I will never forget any of their deeds." I was looking at the Post-Dispatch today, and they have some, their editorial cartoon and some of their comments are on tax policy and tax breaks for the rich. As you probably are aware, Dr. Nolan, we have a debate going on, and I asked this question at the end of the Ask the Pastor Hour on Friday, and it was a mistake on my part. I didn't give the pastor nearly the opportunity, the time that it would take to respond to this. But the so-called Bush tax cuts are going to expire at the end of this year, and if they expire, then everybody will experience a tax increase. There is some debate as to whether or not the rich, the wealthy, should be taxed, but tax cuts should be left in place for the middle class. And if you pay attention to the conversation coming out of Washington, even the term redistribution of wealth has been bandied around lately, suggesting that people who have a lot of money should have their money taxed away from them so that that money can be transferred to people who have less money. Now, since that debate is sort of at the center of tax policy and budget policy in Washington, when I hear Amos 8 verses 4 through 7 and I read, "Hear this, you who trample on the needy and bring the poor of the land to an end," I'm wondering if it's appropriate or inappropriate to take a text like that in the Old Testament book of Amos and try to apply it to the conversation we're having about tax policy, etc., here in America, here in this day and age. Is that an appropriate thing to do?
Well, I think that all the Old Testament has application. The question, what's the proper application? And that's it's just the same thing when you deal with the issue of interpretation of the New Testament. The New Testament's always applicable to Christians until Jesus returns. The question is, what's the proper interpretation of it? So in this case, anytime you're dealing with the Old Testament and you're dealing with the people of Israel and God's relationship to them, you have to look at that in the context of the covenant. So the covenant includes all the laws that you can find in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. That's the whole package huge deal. And that was a, it wasn't just a religious law. It included civil law as well as moral laws. And all these were supposed to be kept. That was part of the deal between God and his people. And where they failed to do that in those specifics, then they were, you know, God wasn't very happy. And the farther away they got from both the actual laws and their principles, the less happy he got. And it's very clear from the prophets that the reason the people of Israel, first the northern kingdoms and then the southern, went into exile and were dispersed is because they failed to keep the covenant that they had originally agreed upon with the Lord. And he had kept his end of the bargain, but they did not. So this is the main thing, interpretation of the Old Testament, is that, you know, which laws, and I couldn't tell you which ones in particular, but there are numerous ones dealing with economics in the Mosaic Code, which ones are being violated that Amos is particularly talking about. So that's the very first level, and you have to deal with it on that level first. Then the second question is there any application at all to us today as Christians? And then the third level, you could say, would be, is there any application at all in the sense of general justice or natural law that would apply to society? You know, and so in other words, Christians have a higher standard of what's expected from us by our Lord. We do not live under a theocracy that follows the Bible in terms of its specific laws. So, but there still are some general principles of justice, both in the economic and in the justice levels, that need to be fulfilled for to have a just society. So you can look at some of these verses and say, yeah, there may be parallels, but to say, well, this exactly this point, it has to exactly be followed today, no, you really can't do that. So that's the overview and how you deal with passages like
that. Well, I guess it's that third level that I'm asking you about. In the Post-Dispatch on the opinion page of today's edition, the political cartoon there shows President Obama apparently trying to address a couple of folks. One is a fat cat smoking a big fat cigar, and the cartoonist has written tax cuts for the rich on him, and he's got a big bag of money that says CEO pay and Wall Street bonuses. And he's linked arm in arm with what looks to be a sultry, not too reputable female who has an elephant's head, so she represents Republicans, I guess. And she's saying to President Obama, I can so say yes. And her yes is to go arm-in-arm with the fat cat. In the USA Today, the political cartoon shows a woman and a man sitting on a park bench, and the woman is reading a paper that has census on it, and she says 1 in 5 American kids live in poverty, according to the government. The man on the park bench apparently is supposed to represent the Tea Party movement. He has on a hat with an American flag on it and a button that says no, and his response is, I hate the government. So the battle lines are drawn here on this question, and I think that anybody who's paying attention in our culture to this question, and I think maybe more than usual are paying attention, now you're sitting in church and you hear perhaps Pastor Nolan reading from the book of Amos. And when he reads, he says, hear this, you who trample on the needy and bring the poor to the land, pour the land to an end. Well, that's that fat cat in the cartoon saying, when will the new moon be over that we may sell grain? Well, that's capitalism. That we may offer wheat for sale? Well, that's capitalism. That we may make the ephah small and the shekel great? Well, that's what we call fraud. Deal deceitfully with false balances? That's what we call cheating. That's that CEO pay and Wall Street bonuses that are in this political cartoon. And then verse 7 says, the Lord has sworn by the pride of Jacob, surely I will never forget any of their deeds. Now, I can take that Old Testament passage there, Pastor, and and pretty much line it right up with the Wall Street, not Wall Street Journal, but the USA Today and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in almost a one-to-one correlation. Am I permitted to do that?
Well, I mean, you're Chuck Rathard. You could do just about whatever you want, Chuck.
And I would be frequently wrong, Pastor. You know, I know what it's like to make a mistake, and that's what I'm trying to find out now. Would that be a mistake?
Yeah, I think that what you're doing there is making a one-for-one correspondence between the political editorial page and Amos chapter 8. And
pretty much that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's what you're doing. And what is, you end up making the same mistake that the preachers do on TV, who will pick up a Bible passage, well, maybe like this, or maybe the book of Revelation, and they'll say, well, the beast said this and did that, and well, now that's the Saddam Hussein over in Iraq, and we have to go beat him up because, well, it's obviously the beast. So what happens there is a one-to-one correspondence between a Bible text and a current issue of the day, and almost always that's going to be an error. Well, what you've got to do is to dig behind the principles that are being talked about, and you have to look at it a little more carefully too. Capitalism per se as a economic system is not about cheating. In fact, if all it is about is cheating, it will collapse in on itself. Capitalism requires a certain measure of trust between the various parties that are lending and borrowing. And I think that the Christian church has had a number of different opinions and positions on capitalism, specifically with respect to the term that was used in the Middle Ages called usury, which is the notion that money can create money on its own without actually being productive. You know, that's what bankers do. We, in our society, we bank. I mean, that's, well, of course, right now we're not getting any interest, but that's just the way our society is. And the whole objection to usury, which goes back to the Greeks, Aristotle thought it was wrong too, was actually overturned by the popes, because the popes had all these building projects and war projects that they had in the late Middle Ages, and they didn't have enough money for it. So they started trying to come up with ways of raising money, one of which was indulgences, but that didn't raise enough money. So they had to borrow money, and they went to the people that had the most, which were the Fuggers in Austria, and I think the Medici also in Florence, and they would borrow money from them on interest. And this then caused a great stir when people found out about it because, well, the church was supposedly against usury and the taking of interest. So that's kind of the history on it. Luther spoke in the tradition of the Middle Ages, and he was generally against usury, especially in its extreme forms. Calvin was generally in favor of it. And this is one of the reasons that the Calvinist religion, or the Reformed religion, replaced the Lutheran religion in many places of Europe. Finally, the Lutherans, maybe about 100 years after Luther, said, well, maybe it's not so bad. So that's, in a short summary, the history of capitalism. So if you say that capitalism in itself is cheating people, well, there is a long history of people that have said that. Our Protestants generally have said, no, it's okay, and pretty much the Catholics agree with it, too. I mean, it's there are very few people that will say capitalism per se is not illegal. It's immoral.
Well, when
there are very few people that will say that anymore.
When you use the term usury, I'm not sure if I understand exactly what you mean by that. Are you saying, I'm thinking of two possibilities. There is one where a borrower borrows money from a lender and then for the privilege of being able to borrow that money, pays that money back with some interest.
Right.
And then there is when a lender charges extreme levels of interest, unfair levels of interest, because he has somebody at a disadvantage, takes advantage of him.
Right.
Now, in which case are you meaning the term usury?
Well, historically, it was used in both senses. Today, we tend to use the term usury to say an abusive level of interest. But historically, and again, up until the time of the Reformation, any taking of interest was considered immoral by the Christian Church. And the other group that they were able to borrow money from were the Jewish people, who, if you look at the... And this is very interesting. There are certain provisions for the taking of or of lending of money and taking of interest in the Old Testament itself. The Jews were prohibited by God from lending money with interest to a fellow Jew, but they were encouraged to do that to the Gentiles because the Gentiles were the enemies. And it says there in a couple of places, as it talks about this, that this is the way that the Jews will under God, and this is under the promised land and the whole covenant issue. It's not talking about things after the time of Christ, but that this is one of the ways that God will help the Jews prevail over against the Gentiles in the promised land. So God himself has, you'd say, a double standard. So somebody that is a brother or part of your clan, you cannot charge interest to them because you should help them, you know, and if they're in need, you need to help them out and not take advantage of them. Whereas one that is not your brother, well, you can go ahead and charge interest. And so that's God himself saying that. So where do you end up with that? You know, in our modern day world, is our neighbor our brother in that sense or not? And that's part of the debates, I think, where some people who have a notion of what may say a more libertarian notion of economics would say, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world, survival of the fittest. Here they use Darwinian notions, and, you know, every man for himself. And if you do well, then you've obviously done the work that you deserve. And if you don't, well, too bad for you. That's not really a Christian attitude, but that's a very common attitude in the United States.
All right.
Under that view, any lending of interest at any rate is okay. Whatever the market will bear is okay. Whereas the Christian view is, yeah, there is some sense of justice, and the question is, who is your neighbor and who is your brother? You know, your brother, that's a big question. I mean, if my own brother... have a brother out in California. If he came into dire circumstances, would I lend money to him with interest or lend money to help him get back on his feet and hope maybe someday he would repay? Now, Jesus has an entirely different thing for the Christians, and that's in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, forgive your debts. So, in other words, if you've lent money to somebody, forgive that. Don't expect the money back. That's an entirely different thing. And, of course, no society economically could operate with that principle. But that's how Christians are to act to their brothers in particular.
Let's take a telephone.
It all depends on who you're talking to.
Let's take a call here, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Good morning, Bill. You're on the Bible study.
Yes, good morning to both of you. I was just going to ask a couple questions. One is, we have a well-known pastor here in the St. Louis area that does a lot of good for the poor, and he uses a lot of scriptures, especially out of the Old Testament, involving how you treat the poor and about trampling on different things, and quite a bit of his emphasis on his theology is on that. And then also he's into ecology, he's real strong, and they even have a part on the right on the TV where it says I confess that I didn't do this and I didn't do that. They're kind of using like confessions like we do in the Lutheran Church, saying we didn't do that, and I think you might even say something about the environment. And I was just wondering, You know, I'm kind of forced a lot of that, but I don't know how biblical that really is. I mean, I'm sure parts of it are. I was just wondering your take on it. And then one more question. I know we have a lot of the same beliefs as the Lutheran Church of Wisconsin Synod, but I was wondering what things would we be in disagreement with them on that? If it's possible, you could explain something on that.
All right, we'll talk about it. Thank you, Pastor. Two questions.
Well, the I don't know the pastor that he's talking about. And of course, the church does have responsibility for caring for the poor, especially its own. In other words, those that are Christians, when they end up in difficult situations, they are to be taken care of by the church. It was an example already at the beginning of the Christian church, where the deacons were appointed as part of their responsibility to make sure that the poor were fed. The church, I'm not talking about the American society, but the church does have some responsibility in the area of mercy or charity. So, you know, if you see people doing this under the name of the church, that's always a good thing. I don't want that to be confused at all. This Bill calling up talked about that this pastor also talks about ecology, and then that probably tells me that the pastor that's involved in this way is into the whole social gospel movement, which today has added ecology as one of the political platforms. And you have to understand with people like this, and I don't even know who this guy is, but for many of these people, the gospel of Jesus Christ of salvation, eternal salvation, and forgiveness of sins, that's not on their plate at all. When I went to Union Seminary in New York City, there were very few people at all that believed what we confess in the creeds, and almost all the professors and students were proponents and believers in the social gospel. For them, that was it. That's why Jesus came on this earth, to help the oppressed, and so people like Gandhi or Martin Luther King would be like modern-day Jesuses to them. And ecology now is the latest plank on this social gospel that many churches are involved with. Is it biblical? I think it's correct for Christians to use this world in a with good stewardship, not only for their own personal benefit, but for the benefit of their children and society. And to look for the future and not just for the present. So that aspect of ecology, I think, is a good thing. But then there are other aspects of ecology or whatever you might want to call it, where they basically make it impossible to do business at all, and basically would make us go back to the Stone Age because you can't make bronze, because bronze... And any sort of metal gives off fumes and stuff like that. So, I mean, they're obviously there, and there are people like this that you'd say, well, this doesn't make any sense. And this is something you don't need to be a Christian to really to understand. And the last question was in the Missouri Synod and the Wisconsin Synod. I'm not sure that we have any different positions on the issues of ecology, social justice, or economic issues. I think we're pretty much about in the same, at least our official positions about the same.
How about doctrinal positions in general? Are there any specific differences between the Wisconsin Synod and the Missouri Synod?
That is a good question. I haven't looked at the official positions, the doctrinal positions of the Wisconsin Synod. I know the Missouri Synod positions fairly well. The problem that both churches have is that they have various levels of authority to these things. So, for example, a document will be issued by the Commission on Theology and Church Relation of either church body, and people will take that as if it's the Word of God, but it really isn't. I mean, it's just a commission that's been appointed to say, well, this is what the best that we can think about this right now. When something comes out of a synod on a doctrinal issue, and they really put a lot of weight behind it, then you can say, well, that really is what the church teaches on
all right.
the subject.
Dr. Nolan, let me take my bottom of the hour break here. You're listening to the Bible study with Reverend Dr. Martin Nolan. We'll be right back.
You go to church and hear about the Bible. But how does the church really use the Bible? Do we use it so that it transforms who we are? Or is the Bible a formality? That's the topic of Concordia Seminary's Theological Symposium, September 21st and 22nd. You are invited. Call 314-505-7486 for information.
Cycling season is here. You're going to ride, so why not pedal the cause to benefit Barnes Jewish Hospital, Children's Hospital St. Louis, the Siteman Cancer Center, and the Cancer Frontier Fund. It begins Saturday, October 9th at 8 a.m. at Soldiers Memorial St. Louis. You can choose a 25 or 57-mile ride, put together a team, or ride solo. Full support along the way. Visit pedalthecause.org for more information. And pedal the cause, Saturday, October 9th.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
An important project we have at Life Issues Institute is called Protecting Black Life. We're educating the African American community. The abortion industry is targeting them as a race. Over 60% of Planned Parenthood abortion mills are in black neighborhoods. A black woman's more than three times likely to have an abortion. Pro-abortion activists in the black community responded saying we're racist. It's sometimes a popular theme in the blogosphere, but one blogger silenced those critics by saying this: a racist would think killing black unborn babies is a good thing. Why are the pro-lifers trying to stop it and save our babies' lives? If the pro-lifers were racist, wouldn't they enjoy this genocide and remain silent? Contact us at today's broadcast link at lifeissues.org to learn more.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
Obama goes to church. I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. President Barack Obama and his family have started the week by going to church. The Obamas attended the Sunday morning service at St. John's Episcopal Church across the street from the White House. The church claims that every president since James Madison has worshipped there. In California, the leader of a breakaway religious sect has been hospitalized for mental evaluation after she and 12 members of her group went missing and left behind evidence they were waiting for the rapture or some catastrophic event. Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department spokesman Steve Whitmore asks,
is it a strange story? Absolutely. But the good news is that the kids, the adults, even the animals, everybody is okay.
The five adults and eight children were found praying at a Palmdale park Sunday. Officers started searching Saturday after family members found letters saying the group would soon see Jesus and their dead relatives in heaven. I'm Steve Coleman.
Have you noticed how often the Bible appears to be against wealth and riches? Or is it just a misreading of the text when someone comes to that conclusion? On the next Law and Gospel, we will be examining one of the most well-known parables of Jesus involving a poor man named Lazarus and a rich man referred to as Dives. Which one of those are you?
Weekdays at 6 on KFUO Radio.
It's the 30th Annual Builders Home and Remodeling Show in St. Charles Convention Center, October 1st through 3rd, with free admission and free parking. Nearly 200 exhibitors will be in three booths on two levels. The Home and Remodeling Show is the source for information, products, and services for the home. Home Improvement His Way, Her Way is part of the lineup with Matt Fox and Sherry Hiller of HGTV's Room by Room. There's more information online at stlhomeshow.com.
Thank you so much for joining us here, listening to our Bible study program, the Ask the Pastor Hour. Our Ask the Pastor program is designed to give you an opportunity to call in, talk with the pastor, ask questions that are on your mind. Our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727 if you'd like to join us with a question or a comment during this hour. Our guest is Dr. Martin Nolan. He is pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Pastor Nolan, I'm going to go to the telephone with your permission.
Okay.
Let's talk with Ms. Harris. Hi, you're on the Bible study. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing today?
Not well.
Not well.
I'm in excruciating pain.
Oh, my goodness.
Mentally, I feel pretty good. I want to, my question is relating to how do we as Christians, how do we look at our obligation toward the poor and the needy and maybe the unintelligent, the ignorant, or whatever? Are we looking at it as if we have a gift from God? The riches are a gift from God, or the intelligence is a gift from God, and we share that with the poor and the needy, or are we getting the big head and saying, you know, this is all my doing, and I don't have to have any obligation toward the poor and the needy?
All right, let's see what the pastor has to say. Thanks for the call. Pastor Nolan?
Yeah, Ms. Harris, that's a good point. I think that is behind the... certainly the New Testament's understanding of gifts of any sort. The word grace in the New Testament is a synonym or a cognate for the word gifts. So they all kind of go together. And, you know, some people have gifts of, as you said, intelligence. Some have, they have other talents that they're able to deploy. Some have inherited an enormous amount of wealth, you know, any number of different things in society, and certainly in the church, people have these different gifts, and the understanding is that it's a gift from God. I mean, it's not a gift that you earned yourself. If you earned it, then it can't be a gift. So if it's a gift from God, then are you sharing it? That's a very good question, and the New Testament talks about this area of financial responsibility is stewardship. And so, for example, the story of the rich man who thought, oh, I've got all I need and I'm going to build some bigger barns. And, you know, part of what's missing is his concern for the poor and the needy. Why did God give him all this? Well, part of the responsibility that he has for all that is to taking care of the poor and the needy. Not all of us have financial wherewithal, where a lot of us could just take care of our own needs, and that's about it. You can ask, well, what is a need? But I think most people can pretty much figure that out. I mean, you need to live in a house, whether you rent or you have a mortgage, whatever. You need to live someplace. You need clothes on your back. You need food. If you have children, they have their needs, and those are basic things. I've always wondered why I need to drive a car, but then I tried one year to get around an American suburb without a car, and it didn't have bus service, and that didn't work out very well. So that ends up being an area of a need. So there's a lot of these things that are variable depending on a person's circumstances, but I think the attitude of the Christian is if you have this, especially if you've got more than what you need, then you have an obligation to share. And that is understood by most churches, that part of your sharing is what goes into the offering plate on Sunday. So your gifts are thank offerings to God. And of course, the church then distributes it in a variety of ways. But if all the church does with those offerings is take care of its own, and it doesn't help take care of the poor or those that are in distress, then it's not meeting part of its calling. It's a little different when you have somebody that's not a Christian. And, well, how can you hold the banner of God's law over that person? And I think that's part of what goes in our society, because there are many people that have a whole lot of wealth, and they have really no real claim to be a Christian or a believer or anything like that. And then people say, well, you know, well, they're not very good people, and, well, maybe they don't care. But that's the way our society is constructed. But for Christians, we do have a higher calling, and that is, again, to take care of our own, that is, those in the Christian community, and then also in the wider community in which we live, our neighbor, as it were. So I think Ms. Harris has got some good points there.
All right. In the same USA Today section that I was talking about before, the political cartoon, if you just flip over to the next page, there is an advertisement there, clearly identified as an advertisement. And it has a dotted line around it, and it says, clip, copy, and share with others. So I'm sharing it with you, Pastor. It says, 8 compelling reasons why Christ is coming very soon. How to be prepared for history's greatest event. The evidence for the soon return of Jesus Christ is overwhelming. It could be any moment. One scholar lists 167 converging clues just in the last few years. The following are 8. Number 1, Israel's rebirth. Number 2, plummeting morality. Number 3, famines, violence, and wars. Number 4, increase in earthquakes. Number 5, explosion of travel and education. Number 6, explosion of cults and the occult. Number 7, the New World Order. And number 8, increase in both apostasy and faith. So when you see an advertisement or an article like this, Pastor, which I have to tell you, for those of us who may or may not be as in touch with the Word of God as you are, this is pretty interesting, if not alarming. What do you make of an advertisement like this?
Well, I first go to Jesus, who has something to say to those who talk about the end of the world. In the temple discourse, I think that's what they call it, but it's the Jesus is walking by the temple with his disciples, and they point to the temple and say, "Wow, look at that! You know, wonderful buildings and all the money that went into that." And then he stops them and says, "Well, you know, this is all going to be gone, not too many years from now." And that was actually about 40 years from the time that Jesus pointed it out. And they said, "Well, when is that going to happen? We'd like to know. We don't want to be around here when all the armies come through and clear it out." And they said, "While you're telling us this, why don't you tell us when the end of the world will be and when you're coming back?" And they ask them 3 questions at once, and it's all mixed up. So you have to read it carefully, but it's both in Matthew and Luke. And then Jesus says, "Well, beware, because there's going to be these people out there that say, well, there's, New World Order, and there's apostasy and faith and Israel's, all this stuff that you just read, Chuck." Jesus is warning you about people that will be saying this as proof of the end times, and Jesus says all these things are going to happen, and they're going to keep on happening until the end comes, and then nobody is not going to know, because it's going to be like a thief in the night. So some of my friends at the seminary years ago, they used to joke about these advertisements that you'd see in the newspaper. And they said, "Well, the fact that they broadcast it in the newspaper means Jesus can't come tomorrow, because everybody knows that he's coming tomorrow, because Jesus said it's a thief in the night and nobody knows when he's coming." A little bit of irony there. But so you have to really take this with a grain of salt and just throw those things away, because they are not useful at all. And I think that the best preparation that we can have is, first off, faith in Jesus' words, and then the second thing, as Martin Luther said, go out and plant an apple tree. An apple tree takes a while to grow. And in other words, continue on your life as if the Lord is going to call you when your full life expenditure, 70, 80 years, whatever that'll be, and plan for that, because otherwise you won't be able to know when he's going to come back. And any of this stuff, the other side from history, is all this stuff has been going on throughout history, and certainly since the time of Christ. All these things that this gentleman mentioned have taken place numerous times. And I, being from California, I don't ever consider an earthquake a good sign of things to be happening, because it happens there all the time.
Well, the advertisement moves through its information here to its conclusion, where it says how to receive him. And it says, in any gift exchange, there has to be a giver and receiver. God has already given us the gift, his Son. Now we must receive him. And then it quotes John chapter 1, verse 12, but as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. So it appears that what they want to do with their advertisement here, Pastor, is to convert people to Christianity. Well, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always a good thing. But you have to use the correct means to do that. And the means of bringing people to Christ is not scaring them to death, which is basically what these people... It's another type of fire and brimstone.
Are you opposed to fire and brimstone preaching, Pastor?
Yeah, well, as that's normally understood, yes, I am opposed to that.
And what does that mean, as it's normally understood?
Well, it means that you preach so that the person feels like, in fact, they become, the idea is to scare the people so badly that they become partially irrational, and then they're willing to do whatever you tell them. That's a rhetorical, oratorical effect that's intended.
Rhetorical, oratorical. Wow.
Or oratorical, yeah. It's the use of oratory or rhetoric, and knowing how to manipulate your audience to the point that they'll do anything to get out of what you've depicted for them. It doesn't have as much effect as it used to because people have become immune to a lot of that. And as a result, they've become immune to the Word of God, unfortunately. But what we are called to do as Christians, and certainly my role as a preacher, is to show people the sin that they have, that they commit, they have in their own nature, that they are sinners, and that they are not going to be adequately prepared to meet the judgment throne. That's not fire and brimstone. That's looking at the area of law and judgment.
Well, Pastor Nolan, it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that in the, can we call it the preaching discipline of Reformation preachers like yourself,
right,
that every sermon you preach must contain an element of law, and every sermon must contain an element of the gospel, and that you are encouraged in your preaching of the law to preach it in all of its quote-unquote wrath and fury. Am I okay so far?
Severity. It's a little bit different.
Severity, wrath,
yeah.
Fury, to me, they all fit pretty much in the same basket. In any case, you're going to scare me to death, aren't you?
Well, it depends on where you stand, but that's not my intent. My intent is to reason with you. And by the way, the word repent means a change of mind. If you've become irrational, I'm not going to be able to change your mind. You're so upset and jittery that I'm not going to be able to reason with you. So repentance means you're changing your mind about who you are and your stance before God. That's what I see the role of repentance. So my goal as a preacher, certainly with those that are not Christians, is to try to make them understand that under God's law, they really are sinners. And that in itself is an accomplishment if you can get them to do that. You don't need to talk about the punishments. You just need to talk about the sin. Now, if they refuse to accept the discussion about sin and God's law, then you can say, well, yes, there are punishments, but that's not the focus of the law. Whereas fire and brimstone preaching, the whole focus is on the punishments. Now, that's a different thing. See, there's a difference between a crime that you commit and the legal process by which you're prosecuted and the punishments that happen at the end. See, so the preaching about the law and about sin is all about the first part. And that's where, that's what good preaching tries to do. And then, of course, the whole purpose is to point people to Christ and say, well, you're not going to be able to satisfy God's demand for perfect life. Only Jesus can do that, and that's why the gospel must predominate. But if people don't believe that, then you still have to show that they are sinners.
505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Let's bring Herman on board here. Hi, Herman. You're on the Bible study.
Thank you for taking my call, and good to hear from you again, Pastor Nolan. I'm in a church with about, let's say, $60,000 to $70,000 a year budget. And to help the poor, we do have a clothing drive every year, and some of our members help out with the food pantry locally. But I get calls from people wanting help with rent or utilities, and if we did that, we'd have a line of cars all the way down the road, and there's just no way our financial situation could take care of that. The bulk of these people who call aren't even members and have never even been here, to my knowledge, and so it puts in a kind of a strange conundrum between, you know, your resources to help and exactly what people are asking for when they come out of the blue, so to speak, and venture that. I think you need to apply a lot of judicious examination and balance to that. And I know a lot of small churches, as most Protestant churches, Lutheran churches, are in a small size. They just don't have that kind of budget resources on hand to for everybody that just comes out of the blue. And I thank you for your comments earlier. They're very good.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Pastor, your impressions?
Yeah, I agree with Herman. In fact, my congregation situation is very similar to his. I get phone calls on my cell phone and my home number at church every day. I get phone calls for people asking for money for utilities or for gas. Or we get people knocking on. We're in the what you might call the inner city area of Evansville. We really isn't that big, but it's definitely the poverty center of Evansville. And so we have vagrants and needy people. We have public housing right across the street from us, a multi-story apartment. And so we get this all the time. And as Herman said, if we were handing out dollar bills, boy, that's all we'd be doing. Because the need is so great, or certainly the desire is there. Our congregation has worked together with other congregations in our local area in Evansville, and they support a community center that has a food pantry. I think a lot of churches do that, either individually or with others, and at least we can give a little. And I look at the membership of my congregation. Most of them are seniors, retirees, and they're living almost exclusively on Social Security. So they don't really have much. I mean, they're taking care of their own needs. You know, and they don't know how long they'll live. They don't know if the resources they have, if that's going to carry them to the end of their life. So I agree with Herman. There's a lot of churches, especially the smaller ones, that really have very little resources. And all they can do, those churches, those congregations, is take care of their own. But the bigger churches or the denominations often have greater resources, and those are the areas where, you know, they can make a bigger impact. I think the Lord has called us to do what we can do based on what He's given us. And I think that's all that we can be faithful with what we've been given. But I definitely, Herman, if we switch pulpits and churches, we'd be more or less in the same boat. So glad to hear from you again, Herman.
There's another caller at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, James. You're next on the Bible study.
Yes, Pastor. I guess my comment after listening to the article and some of the calls is that if you are to answer the question, am I my brother's keeper, you would answer that in a way that would indicate a biblical posture of stewardship. I think the way Nehemiah deals with the usury of the nobles in Nehemiah chapter 5, 1 through 8, indicates that type of a biblical posture and stewardship. And so I would like to ask you, Pastor, why is he angry? Is he not a noble also? And how come he seems to have a neighborly responsibility towards the oppressed, where the other nobles don't have that kind of compassion.
All
could
right.
you take a look and give me a little application of Nehemiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 8?
Pastor, you find that passage?
Yeah, I'm getting there right now. Yeah, Nehemiah helps the poor. This is the heading for that. Men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. It says, some were saying, we and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain. Others were saying, we are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get grain during the famine. Others said, we have to borrow money in order to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. So here is injustice, or unfairness anyway. And the thing is with the, I think the interesting thing about the people of Israel is that you have, even though you do have a type of nobility that exists there, and by the way, God did not want to give them kings, you see something that's it's kind of an egalitarianism in the Old Testament, that all the people of Israel were to treat each other as brothers. And so then this whole idea of egalitarianism carries over into the Christian church, where Christians are to call each other brothers, especially those of the same faith. So, and I think that is the context, the political context, of which this is a real problem. So it's like your cousins are starving to death, and you're not doing anything about it. Well, your uncle's going to have something to say about that with your mom, you know. That's the situation in Nehemiah. The question, why did the rest of the nobles didn't care about it? Well, because they've become hardened, and they did not any longer understand their role, even though this was after the captivity, their role as a unified people of God. And that, I think, is the greatest judgment that you find in the Old Testament against the people of Israel, is that they had acted against their brothers. They were selling their own people into slavery. It's just a horrible thing. Now, you can argue that, you know, Christians can't, I mean, we have to follow the same laws, but as I said before, the Old Testament does not apply to us in the same way. So what you have to do is go to the New Testament and say, what is the expectation for Christians treating other Christians? And then again, as I said before, the third level is when we deal with society, which is not officially Christian. I mean, there are many Christians in the United States, but we're not a Christian society. What are the general principles of justice and fairness that apply there? And that's the whole political level. And this is tax policy, basically. I mean, what we're talking about in the United States is not that we have people buying the poor with silver, which is going back to Amos 8. What we have is tax policy. And what's a fair tax policy? Well, I don't know. I mean, it changes every decade. What is the best way to do that? And I think that it's a healthy thing when the United States debates this, because it needs to be changed every once in a while, because the rich figure out a way always to make more than what's fair. And so it has to be readjusted. I wouldn't say redistributing wealth, but what's the fair tax burden on each class or each group? I think that is something that Christians and Muslims and Jews can all agree with. This is something we need to work on, and we use our political process to do that.
Dr. Martin Nolan, thank you, sir. Enjoyed the conversation. Next time I talk to you, it'll be fall.
Yeah. Thank you for the invitation again to speak, Chuck.
You're very welcome. Pastor Martin Nolan, Trinity Lutheran Church, Evansville, Indiana. Tomorrow we continue in Matthew chapter 13 with Pastor John Schmidtke. Hope you can join us then.
Listen to Chuck Rathard and guest pastors Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study Archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.